Hi, I'm Bruce Bartlett. I'm the author of a new book, Wrong on Race, The Democratic Party's Buried Past, just published by Palgrave Macmillan.
Wow.
Did you want me to say more?
I think we should go forward.
Okay.
Let's keep going. We're still here. Maybe somebody's trying to call me or you. I don't know. Do you hear a beep there?
No, everything's fine.
Okay, let's keep going. I'm fine. Yeah. Bruce Bartlett, hey, I'm privileged to be talking to you. I'm Glenn Lowry, professor of economics here at Brown. Yes, you have this book out on race in the Democratic Party. Why don't you start us off by summarizing your provocative thesis?
Okay, it's basically just a history, and the whole thing is about the Democratic Party from its founding by Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson, two major slave owners, and the Democratic Party's total support of slavery in the years before the Civil War, its opposition to Reconstruction and efforts to help the former slaves after the Civil War. And in the 100 years after Reconstruction, its support in the South of Jim Crow laws and lynching and all the other ugly stuff that we associate with that region of the country, and that brings us down to the present day. And the reason I wrote the book more than anything else is because I really want and believe the Republican Party should be more. Should be trying harder to reach out for the votes of African Americans. And I believe that this is important because insofar as the government has the ability, and it may not have the ability, but insofar as it does have the ability to aid the African American community, it's only going to do so when both parties are competing for black votes. And right now, we have a situation where blacks are taken for granted by the Democrats because they know they're going to get their votes no matter what they do, and Republicans don't even try. And so I think the black community is really in a powerless position, and this is only going to change when their votes are in play. And so I thought, how to get Republicans to read a book about the race issue, which, as you know, Republicans just, they really don't care about it at all, one way or the other. And it was to write a book that talked about the Democrats' ugly history on race. I figured that would, you know, get a Republican interested in reading the book. And then at the end, I talk a little bit about contemporary events, yeah. And we can go into that.
Well, one thing I thought while I was reading the book was the goal of trying to get the Republican Party to not write off blacks, and blacks to not write off the Republican Party is a noble one. But the method by doing this historical recounting of how many Democrats there were who were racist, and of course there were quite a few of them going all the way back, seems strange to me. I mean, in other words, it's as if this history of the Democratic Party was supposed to have some contemporary significance, and if I may say so, I'm not sure you bear the burden of showing me how what Thomas Jefferson says in the Notes on State of Virginia, what Andrew Johnson did during the early years of Reconstruction, or what Dixiecrat Democratic politicians may have done in the decades of the 20th century, how that bears on the questions today about, you know, blacks' relationship to the Republican Party and the Republican Party's relationship to blacks. I mean, can you clarify that for me? What's the relevance?
Well, it may not have any, but I think history is something that's interesting for its own sake.
Sure.
And it is certainly true that history sometimes does have political implications. For example, a few months ago, you may recall, in the New York Times, there was a little back and forth between Paul Krugman and David Brooks and Bob Herbert about a speech that Ronald Reagan gave back in 1980.
Oh, I do. I noted
in,
that.
In Philadelphia, Mississippi,
yeah.
In which he made a passing reference to states' rights. And clearly, those columnists thought that this, you know, obscure speech that took place 27 years ago had some contemporary relevance. And so, and of course, we know that other issues, for example, just about every other year or so, there's a new book or a Hollywood movie about Joe McCarthy, and you know, the term McCarthyism is still bandied about in current political discussions. So I think sometimes the history does have play a role. I'm not sure whether what I've written has that much effect, although it's worth remembering that Robert C. Byrd continues to serve in the United States Senate, and not only was he a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but he was actually an organizer for the Ku Klux Klan. And in 1964, he personally filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for more than 14 hours.
Okay.
And so I think that there are...
I have no brief for, you know, Robert Byrd in particular, or for the Southern segregationist remnant that continues to rattle around in the Democratic Party in general. I'm making no defense of them. You know, I'm just going to give you my impression. If I look at the structure of today's Democratic Party and today's Republican Party, it seems to this African American very clear, what am I missing, that the Democrats are far more our friends than otherwise, speaking as an African American, and that the Republicans, by and large, as a political institution, are not. What have I missed? Now, this debate about Ronald Reagan and Philadelphia, Mississippi, and the symbolism around that, I understand that there's some dispute about the facts, that is to say, whether or not when Reagan made the reference to states' rights in that speech, or whether or not when his campaign chose that venue for him to launch his effort, there was a racist subtext or subagenda. There's some debate about that, and I'm quite prepared to give the benefit of the doubt on that question. But just looking broadly across a range of issues that impact on the lives of African Americans with respect to policy toward the poor, or with respect to law and order stringency, or with respect to things like affirmative action and voting rights and anti-discrimination enforcement, again, I have to ask, with respect to appointments to the Supreme Court and the positions they're likely to take on issues that affect African American lives, with respect to the rhetoric of the people who, I remember when Phil Gramm, for example, and I don't mean to cast aspersions, but I remember him running for the presidency, and I remember him talking about it's time for those riding in the wagon to get out and help the rest of us push. I remember when Jesse Helms was running against Gantt in a reelection campaign in North Carolina, and had about affirmative action that played to, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm giving you an opportunity to help me understand why today, self-respecting African-American ought to take seriously the arguments you're making about the Republicans vis-a-vis the Democrats.
Well, my point about the Reagan speech was simply that if it's permissible for Democrats to bring up 27-year-old speeches by people who are dead to try to influence current public opinion on of the African-American community or whatever it is they thought they were doing when they wrote those columns, then I think it's perfectly permissible for Republicans to bring up the question of Robert C. Byrd and other things. So it's simply a point about the use of history in current
enough.
Political debates. But the rest of what you're saying, you know, gets back to what I said earlier. The whole point of my book was to try to encourage Republicans to become more involved in the race issue. And there's certainly no question that the Democratic Party of today is not the Democratic Party of James O. Eastland and people of that sort from the 1950s and 60s. The party did make a big switch in 1964, and unfortunately so did the Republican Party. There are the Republicans under people like Eisenhower and when Nixon was running in 1960, aggressively courted the black vote, and Eisenhower enacted two civil rights laws, one in 1957, another in 1960, and campaigned in Harlem and did things of that sort. But in 1964, as you well know, Barry Goldwater decided on the advice of Robert Bork and William Rehnquist, among others, that the Civil Rights Act of 64, which was essentially a redoing of the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which the Supreme Court had found unconstitutional in the 1880s, that for that reason, it was still unconstitutional, and he voted against it on those grounds. And the result was the Republicans went from getting about 30% of the black vote down to about 10%, and it's about 10% ever since. And as I said earlier, I think that that's bad for the Republican Party. I think it's bad for African Americans.
Agree.
And I think I tried to discuss some issues toward the end of the book about how I think Republicans can use some policies that they're in favor of to reach out for African American votes and I'm just trying to interest them in the subject.
Yeah, I was very interested in what you had to say toward the end of the book about things like reparations, affirmative actions, and stuff. And I'd like us to talk about that. But first, I want to sort of press on with this. The parties have a kind of ideological identity, each party does, in the Republican Party, the idea that small government, laissez-faire, suspicion of bureaucracy, I don't want the feds poking their nose around in my business, in my state, whether it's about land use out in the West or whether it's about domestic relations in the South. Is that not, I'm asking you, a sort of one of the defining sort of ideological sort of identity dimensions of the Republican Party, a kind of suspicion of government? And don't African Americans have a deeply vested interest in seeing a strong central government? Isn't that historically the only way that African Americans have been able to see our interests, whether it's about civil rights or whether it's about social policy, advance? So isn't there a big obstacle in the path of this goal that you desire of a greater interest in the Republican Party from African Americans, because the Republican Party defines itself in ways that are deeply antagonistic to the interest of African Americans? Am I wrong in saying that? Or I should say, I'm sure you think I'm wrong, so please...
No, I think your description of how they think is exactly correct, but I think that view was developed by a particular set of historical circumstances. I think it's very important to remember, and I speak as basically a libertarian about this, that slavery and Jim Crow and all those other things that we associate with racism could not have existed except if they were enforced by government. Now, when the Civil Rights Revolution began in the 1950s, the problem was state governments in the South that were very much opposed to getting rid of those policies and segregating the schools and the things of that sort. And the only alternative was to use another level of government, the federal government, to force them to act. But I don't think it necessarily follows that today the way to help African Americans is to do more at the federal level. I mean, I know the arguments as well as I do that have been advanced by lots of other people about how a free market policy would be more in the interests of African Americans. But just to speak politically, it's well known that from public opinion polls and things of that sort, that there are many African Americans who share the Republican view on social issues, for example. There's a lot of people in the African American community opposed to abortion and things of that sort. But these have not been issues that change their voting. But I think there's an issue out there today which might, and maybe we can get into that.
Okay.
And that is the immigration issue.
Yeah.
One of the things that I see happening in the political marketplace today is that the Democratic Party is reaching out more and more to the Hispanic community to get the votes of people who have been alienated by the Republican Party's tough on immigration policy. And it seems to me that one consequence of this may be to push African Americans into a more secondary position within the Democratic coalition, because the Hispanic community is larger, it's growing faster. And I think when the next Democratic president takes office, they're going to get a bigger share of the patronage and the benefits that the party has to offer. And if you look at polls also where you ask people, do you think illegal immigrants are taking American jobs, more African Americans say yes than any other group in society. So I think the Republican message on immigration may plow the ground, so to speak, to give them an opening into the African-American community that might not otherwise be there. Now, of course, if Obama wins, that's all off the table. But still, it's a trend that I think is going to have impact in years to come.
You know, what you say, I'm not a political tactician, but what you say sounds like it could well be right to me as a matter of political tactics. We've already seen in the Democratic primary campaign, in the Texas primary campaign in particular, this kind of issue come up. My sense of it is that it's a powerful subtext, that is, conflict between Latino, Hispanic, Mexican American on the one hand and African American on the other within the Democratic Party, and the upsurge of numbers and influence of Latinos.
Well, as you well know, the African Americans have viewed all immigrants as competitors, dating back at least to the big, you know, Irish immigration of the late 19th century. And people like Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass complained about immigrants taking black jobs and things of that sort. So it seems to me that
it's been
my point
true.
Is simply that I think the Hispanic community and the black community are sort of natural political rivals and natural economic competitors. And, you know, maybe some people might think it's, you know, immoral to exploit a cleavage that is naturally there for political advantage, but I mean, that's what political parties do. That's why they exist.
Well, that's where I was going with the previous statement. I mean, at a tactical level, I see it for political advantage, but at a deeper level, I'm not sure. And I was going to try. I mean, I think, you know, this historical reference that you make, Booker T. Washington, watching, you know, that speech that Booker T. Washington gave in the late 1890s
at the Atlanta Exposition
about cast down your buckets where you are.
Yes.
You know, he's arguing to American industrialists that they should be using the labor that's available to them in the United States already, African-American labor, and of course the blacks had to stand in line while millions of immigrants came from Europe into the growing American economy and, you know, getting themselves established in unions in the big cities and so forth. And it was many decades before blacks got anything like parity and access to those jobs, a fair point. And I think many sociologists who study labor markets in big cities in the United States today, in New York City, in Los Angeles, I think of this fellow at UCLA, his name is Roger Waldinger in particular, who has a couple of books on the subject, have documented very clearly the adverse effects on the position of African-American low-skilled workers in these urban labor markets of the large numbers of immigrants coming mainly from Mexico and who are taking these jobs. So there's no doubt that that conflict exists. I mean, on the other hand, you know, one could take the high road here. One could say of African-Americans that to African-Americans, and as an African-American, one could say, you know, our experience here with racism and discrimination and being marginalized in American society ought to make us understand the human claims that people who are just trying to get ahead and who have come to this country to do nothing but to work hard and to get themselves ahead. The kind of decency of our response ought to be driven by a sense of seeing these people's humanity and whatnot. And maybe African Americans ought to be big enough to resist the temptation today to cast this problem in this kind of, you know, black and white terms. You know, they're here to take our jobs, they're against us, we have to be against them. And maybe they ought to think in the long term that, you know, working class people, lower middle income people, people who are on the bottom rungs of American society have much more in common than they do that separates them, and ought to be trying to create political coalitions to get policy at the state and federal level to more reflect their interest rather than the interest of the rich and the powerful. So is there not, I mean, I want to hear what you have to say about this counter-argument. Let's not just pit blacks and Hispanics against each other. Let's try to, in an Obama-like fashion, see beyond the conflicts, the immediate conflicts, to a higher ground where these groups might be able to cooperate. And if they were able to do this, it seems to me they would be much more likely to do so as members of the Democratic Party coalition than in the Republican Party.
Well, that will undoubtedly be the Democratic response to my proposal, if the Republicans choose to utilize the immigration issue in the way I've suggested. But, you know, I'm very sympathetic to immigration. I'm not expressing a personal opinion here. I'm just playing devil's advocate, so to speak, and talking about political tactics. And I'm not the one, and it's not the Republicans or anybody else who's creating the cleavage that's already there. We can see it, as you alluded to, in the primary votes already.
Yeah.
The Hispanics and the Latinos are voting very heavily for Hillary Clinton. Very few are voting for Barack Obama. He's getting the overwhelming majority of the black vote. And so they're clearly going in different directions within the Democratic coalition already. And now they both can't win. We're not going to see a Clinton-Obama ticket. So whichever one of them wins, somebody is going to be alienated. If Hillary wins, then the black voters are going to be very upset. If Obama wins, there's going to be a lot of Hispanic voters who may not be altogether thrilled about voting for him, even though they're Democrats. So, you know, I'm not creating these cleavages. They're there.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I was just thinking that what happens if one or the other wins depends a lot, doesn't it, on how the loser conducts himself or herself, and how the loser and their various allies and surrogates decide to act and behave. You know, they can try to pull the party together and tell their followers, etc., you know, let's get behind, it's over, let's concentrate on the general election, or they can lick their wounds and go off and, you know, throw a fit. That's really up to them.
Of course, and we don't know today how that's going to happen, and whether how that happens may depend a lot on how close it comes down to at the very end, because it's probably going to come down to these super delegates and who can you know, put the most pressure on them and all this sort of stuff. In other words, if you lose, you know, if you feel like you've lost,
yes,
because the rug was pulled out from under you, that's one thing. Then if you feel you lost fair and square, and right at the moment we don't know how that's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about how you see current policy terrain and what the opportunities are, aside from immigration, for Republicans to make inroads. You had some interesting things in the book to say about affirmative action and the reparations debate. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you could reprise that for us.
Sure. Just to recap a little bit, I think there's three reasons to believe the Republicans might have some opportunity going forward to make inroads with the black vote. One we've talked about is the immigration issue. Another is, I think there's a growing generation of voters who have been born and come of age in the post-civil rights era since the 1960s, who I think are not as, you know, emotionally committed to the Democratic Party as perhaps their parents and grandparents were, who are more pragmatic and willing to listen to an offer from the Republicans if a sincere one is made. But I think that although these things may sort of plow the ground a little bit, the Republicans still have to put something on the table. And I've thrown out the idea of reparations. And first let me say that this is not just a political tactic. I genuinely believe there is a debt that is owed to African Americans, to the descendants of former slaves, shall I say. And it's just a terrible tragedy of history that in 1865 we didn't just give them all 40 acres and a mule and confiscate all of the wealth of the former slave owners to pay for it, and that would have wiped the slate clean. But, you know, unfortunately we didn't do that. The Republicans actually passed a bill to do that and was vetoed by Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, I know.
The way I look at it is, if somebody injures you, if you're some mugger beats you up, it's you're not going to consider it sufficient if he just says, okay, I'm not going to beat you up anymore. You're going to say, no, I want some compensation for my pain and suffering. And what we did to the slaves is we said, okay, we're not going to enslave you anymore. We're not going to beat you, and now we're going to torture you. But you're on your own. You know, make it on your own. We're not going to offer you any assistance or do anything to repay the pain and suffering that you suffered for hundreds of years. We just said sink or swim on your own. And then we didn't even do that, because we put a chain of Jim Crow laws around their necks, and they continued to suffer for another 100 years until we finally stopped doing that in the 1960s. But there's a debt that was created by slavery, and in another debt, or perhaps an enhancement of the same debt, that was created by Jim Crow, and we've never paid that debt. And I think it's still owed to somebody. And now how you pay that debt is another matter. In the real world, we do that through courts and, you know, you have testimony and juries and stuff like that. We have to do this through the political system. And I think it's something Republicans could use as a framework around which to develop some Republican-friendly, black-friendly policies to reach out to the African-American community And this would be a once and for all, wipe the slate clean payment for racism, and just so we can start from scratch, get rid of affirmative action, get rid of minority set-asides, pay whatever we have to pay, and figure out what the policies are. And at least it's a promise that I think is worth exploring if it has the potential to do what I would hope it would.
Yeah, I want to talk about this with you, but first I have to ask you, do you know any other Republicans? Are you the lone one there who would argue this? I mean, this is such a novel and shockingly un-Republican thing to be saying, so it seems to me.
Well, so far I'm by myself, but I always have hope. I mean, I've done radio shows and things on this, and I get very, very hostile reactions, as you might imagine. But like I said, it's an idea. One of the problems you run into is people have this idea that we're just going to mail out government checks to everybody who's black and or people who can prove they're the descendants of slaves. And that's all nonsense. I mean,
sure.
I'm talking about a policy that is directed in a general way towards the African American community, and we all know who we are, and we can do that if we want to. One idea, for example, I've toyed with is how about if we come to an understanding that the basic problem of the African American community vis-a-vis the white community is one of human capital, and we need and maybe that lack of human capital can be traced to a lot of things, racism, bad schools in the ghettos, and all this other stuff. And maybe for one generation we can make a special extra effort to lift up the children of black children. And that's very important to have a limited period of time, because say we picked 20 years and we said, okay, for this 20-year period only, any African-American child who gets admitted to an accredited four-year university will have all their expenses guaranteed by the federal government. Then if you had that, maybe the students, the teachers, the parents, the administrators, everybody would say, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that we cannot afford to waste. So no more screwing around. You're going to do your homework. If I hear you criticizing another black child for acting white, you're the one who's going to get punished. Everybody's going to straighten up and fly, right?
Okay.
Because we cannot. So that's just one idea.
Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah, I think I get it, and I want to push back. And maybe it's a little bit ironic here. You're the Republican. I'm the Democrat. You're the white guy. I'm the black guy. But I want to push back. I mean, one thing I think is, how could you ever imagine implementing massive human developmental policy, which I would favor, in a racially exclusive way, no matter what the rationale historically might be? The fact would be massive institutions would be created, billions and scores of billions of dollars would be allocated. People would be, as you just suggested in the last example, getting scholarships. They would be getting a leg up. And it would be being done entirely on the basis of this superficial racial trait that people have. Now, the fact that I descend from someone who was a slave 100 or 150 or 200 years ago, it seems to me hardly has any bearing on our contemporary politics. And that there's something again, I'm a Democrat. I'm an African American. I ought to be
it's deeply troubling to me that we would
do something like that in the 21st century in this
country. Let me emphasize something that maybe I glossed over a little bit. I view this as a substitute for the existing ad hoc efforts. I mean, we have affirmative action, and we're not going to get rid of it unless, there's lots of people like Ward Connerly and others who are out there saying, let's get rid of affirmative action. But I think as a practical matter, we're not going to do that unless we substitute something else in its place. I think it's very unfair to just say to African Americans, okay, we're going to get rid of the one thing we do as a society to try to compensate for the past harm that we've done, and we're not going to give you anything else in return. It's back to the old lift yourself up by the bootstraps strategy.
Yeah, but Bruce, I don't view affirmative action as something given to blacks because of the past. I know that argument is out there. I view it as an administrative tool for institutions today to try to manage the difficult problems of doing what they do in a diverse, racially divided society. So, for example, those briefs that went in the University of Michigan Supreme Court cases a few years ago from military academy commandants and from personnel directors at big corporations and such, they argued for affirmative action not as a quid pro quo or a payment for past wrongful acts directed to blacks. They argue for it as, how can you run a modern military in this society if you don't have the means of bringing at least some members of all the different ethnic groups into your West Point or your Naval Academy or your Air Force Academy? And if we rationed those seats entirely by test scores, we would get far too few African Americans and Hispanics. And so we want affirmative action to be preserved so that we can constitute our personnel policies in a way that makes sense against the social realities that we have to function in. Similarly, the corporations would say, you know, in a globalizing, multi-ethnic, multiracial environment, we need to be able to bring blacks in and move them along, and we want a little bit more latitude to be able to do that. And even if the developmental policies that you and I favor toward expanding educational opportunity and such were to be enacted, it would be many decades, I should think, if they were to be as successful as we would all hope, before there would be no need for some extra latitude to meet these representational goals. So there's a different model of affirmative action. The one that says the University of Michigan can't exist in the state of Michigan, 35 miles from Detroit, and have 2% African Americans in their student body. The state legislators who oversee their budget are not going to stand for it. And they need the latitude to be able, in a reasonable way, to get to 5 or 6% African American in their student body instead of 2%.
Well, you're really, in a way, supporting my argument, which is that we cannot get rid of affirmative action unless we substitute something else for it. It serves a purpose. And I don't, and the problem, of course, historically has been that it becomes a quota system, and you end up rewarding people who don't deserve it. The children of the middle class get benefits. It doesn't really filter down to the people at the bottom who really need it. But the real point I was trying to make when I brought up affirmative action is, you were saying, against my idea about reparations, how can we have this race-based policy?
You say we already have.
And I'm saying we already have one. And a lot of people, maybe you, I don't know, don't think it's working very well. And I do think there is a case to be made that it poisons race relations and maybe offsets a lot of the gains that it may also bring about. Well, and so I think it's certainly worth a rethink.
I want to tell you and everybody else what I think about affirmative action, just in very brief compass, which is that it's just a policy. And it is overblown, both by its advocates as the salvation for black America. There'd be no black middle class but for affirmative action. I believe that's demonstrably false. And by its detractors, who say that it necessarily is so profoundly racially divisive and cuts against the grain of our ideas about merit. Because I think there are many compromises to our ideas about merit that we countenance every day. That the world is not, a level playing field in so many respects. And I think, as I said, that this is a management tool for particular institutions, these elite, highly selective institutions. They're like 1% or one half of 1% of all of what's going on in American society. And it's really the demand for racial diversity amongst elite cadres that drives the affirmative action thing. And so I don't think it's a. I don't think that the exchange that you're proposing is appropriate. And the reason I don't is because, on the one hand, these developmental activities that you're talking about ought to be done anyway, and they ought to be done not only for blacks but for disadvantaged or needy
Americans. If we could get back to the original notion of affirmative action, of just being a private effort to reach out and try to help people and give them an extra benefit of a doubt, so to speak, that would be fine. But when it turns into quotas, then which it has, as you know, it becomes a barrier. And so I think that maybe we'll never get rid of affirmative action in totality, but maybe we can at least use my idea as a mechanism to get back to its original intent, and maybe even eliminate the need for it if, as you and I think we both agree, the real problem is one of human capital, and how do we raise blacks up to where they don't need affirmative action, where they can compete on their own and do well.
Yeah, we do agree about that. Let me ask you about something else, because there's something really interesting in your book about Nixon and the Southern strategy. So, everybody knows, I put that word in quotes, everybody knows that Richard Nixon got himself elected president and reelected and attempted to consolidate his governing majority by cynically manipulating racial sentiments in the population, that Richard Nixon had a Southern strategy, that Richard Nixon promoted affirmative action because he knew it would be divisive between the labor unions and the blacks and the Democratic Party, that Richard Nixon foisted law and order because he knew that it would appeal to white people who were resentful after the riots of the 60s and who viewed blacks as a threat and so forth and so on. And you argue exactly the opposite in your book. I think everybody deserves to be able to hear your argument, and I want us to talk about it.
Well, first of all, it's worth remembering that Richard Nixon always had a very good record on civil rights as a senator and vice president, and in fact, you know, worked very hard to get around, because of course he was the presiding officer in the Senate. He worked to get around Southern Democratic filibusters and things of that sort. And wrote a number of things that were very supportive of civil rights, supported the Civil Rights Act of 64. But let's remember the history. In 1968, when Nixon ran for president the first time, or well, the second time, who was he running against? Hubert Humphrey, hero of the civil rights movement from going back to 1948, and George Wallace.
Yes.
Now, Wallace was clearly the guy with the Southern strategy. It would have made no sense for Nixon to try to run a Southern strategy when Wallace was in the race. That would have been crazy. So if you actually look at the substance of his campaign in 1968, it was a classically centrist strategy. And I would just mention also that when he put Spiro Agnew on the ticket, we have this memory of Spiro Agnew as some kind of arch-conservative, but he was the governor of Maryland, a fairly liberal state then as well as now. And he was considered one of the most liberal Republicans in the country. And he had made a name for himself pushing open housing laws in the state of Maryland. That was his claim to fame. And that was the reason why Nixon put him on the ticket, is because he was a liberal on civil rights. And one of the very first things Nixon did the day he took office in January 1969 was to make a major push to integrate Southern schools, which were just about as segregated in 1969 as they had been in 1955, right after the Brown decision. Kennedy and Johnson, for all their activity and talk on civil rights, actually didn't do much in the administrative area to actually implement civil rights, where they had already the power and the responsibility to do so. And Nixon did that. He made a massive push to integrate the Southern schools, and he was quite successful. By 1971, I don't remember the numbers, they're in my book, but there would have been an enormous increase in black children going to integrated schools and a massive reduction in the number of segregated schools throughout the South. And guys like Wallace were just appalled. The Southerners were very, very angry about all this, that's just historical truth.
I'm no expert on the history, but I somehow have the impression that Nixon nominated someone named Carswell for the Supreme Court, who was at least in some quarters seen as a pro-segregationist or unsavory on racial issues type. Am I wrong about that?
I know that Haynesworth and Carswell were nominated and rejected. I don't know. I'm afraid I don't know the history of that. I do know that the one time, I mean, Nixon was not beyond cynical politics. Believe me, I'm not a defender of Nixon.
Well, that's where I'm going.
I mean,
at one point
he actually floated the name of Robert C. Byrd as a potential Supreme Court appointment.
An act of diabolical genius.
Because it then forced the liberals to turn against, you know, a Democrat.
Right.
And actually a lot of the of what we know about Robert Byrd's record as a member of the Klan came from research that was done during that time period.
I see.
I'm not trying to defend Nixon per se.
Yeah, what about the Philadelphia Plan? This is going to be another one of my examples. Somehow recall having read that the internal deliberations within Nixon's Labor Department and White House were sort of cynically seeing the Philadelphia Plan being the affirmative action plan to bring blacks into the construction trade union jobs in the city of Philadelphia and beyond.
Well, yeah.
And knowing that, you know, that was going to piss the unions off but and pit the blacks against the unions within the Democratic Party to the Republicans' advantage.
Well, this is a case where I think doing the right thing actually was good politics for Nixon as well. The problem you had at that time is that blacks had made a lot of progress in terms of getting into industrial jobs that had been denied to them previously, but the buildings trades were a particular problem because it was very heavily unionized.
Yep.
Now, the federal government could give out contracts for buildings and say, we want you to hire more blacks,
right,
and the construction companies would say, well, fine, we're happy to hire more blacks. The problem is, we're limited to only hiring unionized workers. So something has to be done first to get the unions to admit blacks before we can then hire them to work for us. So there needed to be something to deal with the problem of racism in the labor unions. And that was what the Philadelphia Plan was all about, was to try to force labor unions to bring in more black members. And not and of course it also had the benefit of pitting the unions against the blacks, both of whom were members of the Democratic coalition. So it was kind of a win-win situation for Nixon, although he later said that he didn't think it actually did him any good politically. And I think he's right about that. It didn't help him politically. But it was still, I think, the underlying purpose of it was not as cynical as it sometimes is portrayed.
Now, many of us who are concerned to see, you know, 2.25 million people under lock and key, half of whom are black in the country, and who think the war on drugs hasn't been the best public policy, and who are, who are looking at the rhetoric of crime and anti-crime politics from, you know, the Willie Horton ad in the 1988 campaign on forward, feel that that there's a racial subtext in that and it's of course one that's been exploited by Democrats as well as Republicans. I'm not saying this is a Republican problem, but I'm interested in your take on this, mm-hmm. whether or not the discussion in our domestic politics about crime and punishment and prisons and criminals and the threat of crime, the need to keep judges from being able to give light sentences and all the rest, the need to, you know, Bill Clinton going back to execute that fellow during the 1992 mm-hmm. campaign in order to establish his bona fides as a tough guy and so forth and so on, that there's a racial aspect to that. Do you see that? Do you agree with that view?
Well, first of all, let me just add as an aside, because Willie Horton always gets brought up, you know as well as I do, it was Al Gore who first raised the issue of Willie Horton during the Democratic primaries in 1988.
Yeah, Al Gore started it, but he didn't run that ad.
But neither did George W. Bush, or H.W. Bush, I should say. It was run by an outside group, but that's just an aside.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, I think all your points are quite valid, but if you kind of, but they're in my view, I think they're essentially extraneous to the central point, which is the drug issue. And there is, as is well known, an enormous disparity between the use of crack cocaine and powder cocaine that the Sentencing Commission is trying to redress.
Right.
But I think ultimately all the stuff you're talking about in terms of crime and its disparate impact on the black community ultimately comes back to the drug issue. Now, being a libertarian, I think if you want whatever you want to stick into your veins or snort up your nose is your business. And until we address the drug issue and do something to moderate its impact, I think all this other stuff is just kind of we're around the periphery. And I think that's all wrong. It's wrong not just because it has a disparate racial impact, but because it's just inherently wrong. And until we address that, I don't know what else we can do.
Well, you and I can certainly agree about that. There's just not any doubt about it. I mean, I was astounded when Ron Paul was the only person in the presidential pantheon of either party who was prepared to, you know, just forthrightly and directly address this, not only as a matter of sentencing disparity around crack and such, but, you know, the much more fundamental issue of this is massive government intervention in the lives of people. This is the power of the state being brought to bear coercively on people for basically minding their own business and doing their own thing. And it's deeply problematic, and I think it is deeply problematic. But it also seems to be untouchable. I mean, the Democrats couldn't even agree to loosen up on marijuana a little bit, you know?
No.
So I don't know how we think we're going to make progress on this one.
I don't know either. And, I mean, one of the things about the drug issue that I think is just doubly insane is the way they restrict pain medications for people who are dying.
Yeah.
You know, like, give them whatever they want, for Pete's sakes. I mean, you know, we can all potentially envision ourselves into that situation, and yet it's one of these peripheral issues to the war on drugs that just makes utter no sense whatsoever. And I'm very frightened about the possibility of ever being in a hospital and having to suffer because some idiot is deemed, you know, you're only allowed so much morphine because we don't want you to get addicted, you know. Just insanity.
Let me ask you this, Bruce, and I'm kind of getting to the end of my time here, but if I may just raise one more issue with you, and that's in the current campaign, we've got a black guy running for president in the Democratic Party who's got a real good chance of getting the nomination. If he does, that's going to set back your program by quite a wide margin, isn't it?
Well, there's no question about that. I hadn't banked on the Obama phenomenon when I wrote the book.
Right.
But look, just to be, you know, sort of practical about this, so we going forward, we have two options, right? If Hillary wins the nomination, she'll have to do it through underhanded tactics, or at least tactics that will be viewed as underhanded by Obama supporters. And if she gets the nomination, there's going to be a hell of a lot of very angry Obama supporters who may be very receptive to my argument. The alternative is Obama gets the nomination, and we know, because as sure as the sun rises in the east, that if he's the nominee, at some point during the campaign, some Republican somewhere somehow is going to say something racially stupid, because we've already seen Democrats do this, right? We've seen Hillary Clinton disparage, you know, Dr. King, and we've seen Bill Clinton.
Well, I don't agree with that, but go on, and I'll get
my say. But I'm just saying that we've already seen some comments made by Bill and Hillary and other supporters of theirs about Obama that would probably be bigger news if they had been said by Republicans. And so we're not going to be able to get away from the race issue, and Republicans will need my book to respond and say, yeah, but what about all this other stuff? So
okay.
I think there's a market for my book, regardless
way,
of which way it goes.
You know. But here's what I want to say about the, I mean, Hillary Clinton in particular. I mean, I think it's vastly overblown. Orlando Patterson has an op-ed in the New York Times arguing that Hillary Clinton's red telephone ad that ran in Texas asking at 3 a.m. who do you want to answer it, someone who's had experience or someone who hasn't, arguing that it reminded him of Birth of a Nation, you know, D.W. Griffith, the Ku Klux Klan, and so forth. It seems to me that the race card is being played here by the Obama campaign in a way that has a tinny ring to it and really wouldn't carry in a general election. I mean, they can accuse Hillary Clinton of being a racist because she points out that Lyndon Johnson's skills as an executive in getting his legislation through the Congress were critical for the enactment of the civil rights laws. They can go ballistic and say that that's a racially insensitive remark, but that kind of attack on John McCain is going to go nowhere in a general election, it seems to me. Do you agree with that?
I don't know, but I do know that so much of what we're talking about here is in the mind of the beholder, right?
Well, yeah, that's right.
And people are going to say things because they think it will have a political impact, even though the substance of it may not be at all what it seems. And that's just the nature of political warfare. And so we know with certainty that the race issue will be part of this campaign one way or the other, and one would hope that it would not be. And frankly, I'm one of the people who very much like Barack Obama, and I think that would be an enormous step forward in trying to end racial strife in this country, and it would bring into play a new generation of black leaders who might push aside the race mongers like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, who I think have long outlived their usefulness.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I want to say here is that the Obama camp had better be careful not to protest too much about racial insensitivity, because while it is a very real issue, I think there's also the potential for backlash out there against those claims. People would say, what, you're calling me a racist just because I want to know whether or not the guy's qualified to direct our military in a time of war? It's a fair question, and I want him to answer it, kind of thing like that.
No, I agree with you. It's going to be more difficult once it becomes a Republican-Democrat general election issue than it is right now, where it's a primary issue.
Well, listen, Bruce Bartlett, my pleasure to be able to talk with you about your book, and good luck with it.
Thank you.
And sorry I have to sign off now, but, duty calls.
I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You take care.